Okay, let's try it again. This is the last in the four-part series, and it's very good that yesterday I listened to a Beryl Wine tape where he was talking about public speaking. He said in a public speech, he said, basically you need to take off, fly, and land. And a lot of people blow it. They spend too long flying, or they say where are they going to land before it, or they miss the runway when they're landing. And even though I know how to write a class, it was so good to hear that, because it was very tempting today. As I was making my sheet, I put in way too much. And I realized, because I want to leave you with everything, but I can't. So you just have to remember that this is just the tip of an iceberg, and there's much more to learn and keep growing, and we'll just take off, fly a little, and land. So, but we won't fly all over the country. Okay. So this class, Mem. The class that focuses on the letter Mem of the word Shalom. And the letter Mem has two forms, an open form and a closed form. So the letter Mem teaches us about boundaries. And the quest is, when should you be open and when should you be closed? And how can you be both at the same time? And that's what I really want to look at tonight. Being open and being closed. When to be private, when to be public, when to share yourself, when to protect yourself and guard yourself, when to share your husband, when to guard him, when to share your children, when to guard them. These are all questions that we'll look at in the letter Mem. What's your thought?
When you're teenagers.
Right. Right. You can share away in terms of sending them off, but there still is, which we'll talk about, how you talk about people in that kind of sharing and that kind of protecting. But certainly you want to share them with others. It's very good to have friends raise your kids. That's what I learned. I think it's from Dr. Oleski. Rabbi Oleski? I'm pretty sure it's him. He said that everybody knows how to raise each other's kids. It's their own they have a hard time with. So his advice is, everybody, raise the kids to your left.
That's great. I like
that too. And it's worked out pretty well. We've raised some other people's kids, and we have other people participating in the raising of our kids. It works out very nicely.
No, you would have to take to the left.
Right, you see how I went to the left, because I'm dyslexic, so that's the way it goes. Okay. So last week, the homework was thinking about a goal in the morning and working on the critical review at night. So if anybody wants to share anything or ask a question about that, this would be the time. Of course, you can ask privately later on. But and then the thinking, also taking time to think. So this morning, I took a walk around the lake, which I hardly ever do, but I went outside to take out the recycling, and it was so gorgeous. Mm-hmm. At 8 a.m., how could you not? So I called three different friends who all said they're too busy, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm too busy too. I really shouldn't, and the lake is kind of far away. It's not that far away, but it's 3 miles around. It's going to take an hour to do it. And I thought, no, that's it. I have a 9:30 appointment. It's 8:15. If I get in the car now and drive to the lake, I can make it around and come back in time for my appointment. Mm-hmm. And I just did it, and without anybody. So then I was thinking, as I'm walking, this is great. Now I can think. I have some of that time to really work on some thoughts. So I prepared for the appointment that I had, a phone appointment that I had, and thought about some classes and took the time to breathe and look at the mountains. And I really, and some things, like I was thinking about, you know, Esa Einai El HaHarim, that I could lift up my eyes to the mountains and how beautiful they are. And Mara Buma Asecha Hashem, and look how beautiful everything that you make is, Hashem. So I was thinking, I looked at the distance like that, but then when I looked right next to me at the water's edge, I thought, well, it's kind of scrappy looking weeds there. And I was thinking, if I was that close to the mountains, they'd look scrappy too. It's from here that they look so beautiful. So it made me just think about how sometimes people look at Judaism. They often look so close that it looks kind of scrappy, rather than having the step back perspective and see the majesty of the whole picture. So we do need to live close in, but sometimes we do need to step back out so we can see the majesty of the big picture. So those are some of the thoughts I had on my walk, in case you're wondering what to think when you have a chance to think. I'll just give you some examples of my running stream of consciousness. Okay, so what I want to start with is talking about creating space. So that's what I have on the top of your sheets. So a way that I've often explained what Shabbos is, or what the Shabbos laws are, is there's do's and there's don'ts. The don'ts create space, and the do's fill it. So the don'ts push away all the mundane, and then create the space that you need in order to have Shabbos. There are some people in the world who are committed to halachic practice that aren't so into the Jewish thing, but they're not going to leave it. They're raised it, and they're not leaving it. So they do a lot of the, or they refrain from a lot of the don'ts, but they don't always do the do's. And so Shabbos is kind of a difficult place for them because it's a lot of nots and not enough yeses. So it's not a pleasant place to be. It's just like kind of restrictive. So there's do's and there's don'ts. The don'ts push away everything else that there is space, and then all the do's fill the space. It's important to fill the space to a double procedure. So as I was explaining this to my new partner in Torah, Heather McLeod, a nurse in Wyoming, she said, she's so interesting, she said, that's kind of like how Hashem created the universe. I said, it is? She said, yes. First he created space, and then he filled it. I said, that's right. You're thinking about the Kabbalistic concept of Tzimtzum. Hashem is everything. In order for the universe to come into existence, he had to contract himself, create space. And then in that space, after the contraction, then the Kabbalists say, spun a thread of light. And from that, everything emanated through the ten sefirot, and he made the world. So, but first he had to create space and then fill it. So that's our job. We talked about last time how we create through the seven sefirot, symbolized by the seven walks around our chasen under the chuppah. But in terms of creating our home, we create the space and then we fill it. So creating space or delineating space. Hi, come on in. There's two chairs there. There's enough space, yeah. So we want to emulate Hashem by creating space and filling that space. So one of the things I was thinking about in this is the difference between the words bore and yotzer. So those are two words that are used in Hebrew for create. But bore, like bore pri hagafen, or Hashem's the bore olam, that word is only used for God. Only God can be bore. Humans can't bore. Bore means creating something from nothing. Yotzer is what humans can do. And God also is Yotzer. Yotzer ha'adam, right? There's all kinds of brachas that, and in the davening we talk about Yotzer. But Yotzer really means creating, but creating like knitting. To use a close example. Creating like pottery. Right? So I didn't create the sheep, even if I helped raise the sheep, and even if I sheared it, but I didn't make the sheep. And so it's shaping. What we do is shape. When we take raw materials, the potter didn't create the mud, but he shapes it. So he created the vessel, but not the material from which the vessel is made. So we human beings don't create the material, but we shape it. So our creation is often delineation, not creation. Delineation, making the gvulot, right? Setting up the boundaries of something. To delineate means to make the lines around it. So that's the kind of creation and creating space in our homes, is delineating the space. So that's the closed mem, is saying, this is my space. This is, whether it's your home or the idea of your home, but your actual physical home has a space, and once you close all the doors, the rest of the world is on the outside, and you're on the inside, that's your space. So when all the doors are closed, you have delineated your space. But then there's the psychic delineation of space too. What are you cutting out when you close those doors? And that's something that all of us need to think about on our own levels, wherever we are, but to think about the process of cutting out. We are cutting off the rest of the world. So it's sort of like choosing a major or choosing a spouse, right? When you're little, the world is your oyster. You can do whatever you want. And that's what's so hard about being a sophomore in college, is finally saying, what do you want? Because if you choose something, you can't be everything else. And it's a very hard transition to make, especially at that age, 19 or so, when you're still in the process of every single day you wake up, you're bigger, stronger, smarter, and more capable than you were yesterday. And you just expect that to be your constant trajectory. That's the way you've always been. Every day that you woke up in your life so far until age 19, you've been stronger, smarter, and more capable than the day before. And your parents told you, you could be whatever you want to be. Now at 19, you have to pick. What? I finished my core curriculum. What do I want to be now? And that's a very hard choice. If you want to be a nuclear physicist, so you're not going to be a pianist. If you want to be the pianist, then you're not going to be a politician. And if you want to be the politician, then you're probably not going to be a doctor. Doesn't mean there's not career changes, but you do have to pick at that point. The picking, the hard part of it, is cutting off all the other possibilities. Because if you have all that breath, you can't get depth. So you have to cut off breath in order to get depth. And that's the same thing about picking a mate. When you're dating, the world's your possibility. Every single guy that passes you by, you check. Am I interested in him? I'm not interested in him. Is he Jewish? Is he not Jewish? Will I make an income? Will he not make? Will he be faithful? Will he not be faithful? Is he handsome? Is he not handsome? You know, you're asking all these questions, every single one. Once you make your decision, that's it. You have to stop checking out everything else, because in order to get the depth, you have to give up the breadth. The depth and the breadth here come at the expense of each other. So in creating the space of our home, we have to figure out what are we cutting out so that we can get the atmosphere that we want. And that's an individually answered question. Excuse me, everybody has to decide for themselves what they want to cut out. Some typical examples in an Orthodox home would be many forms of media, whether one would want to cut out TV or certain parts of TV. My mother, who was not Orthodox, as you all know, was still very careful about what she cut out. No Barbies. She didn't want us playing with something like that, where the shape of the body was completely unrealistic and our whole play would be about changing clothes. Barbies out. Guns out. No war. We're pacifists. Not pacifists, but we're not violent. We're nonviolent protesters. Let's see. TV also was strictly limited, even though she couldn't, even though she didn't want me to watch I Dream of Jeannie, which I loved. But she didn't like that show, I Dream of Jeannie, because she's Barbie. She was Barbie. She was subservient to her husband. She was silly and not capable of making her own decisions, and she's constantly foiling the plans of the Seicheldick captain. And right? I mean, that she, and I loved that show because I wanted to be magic. I didn't even think about the relationship between man and woman. That my mother, right, Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie were my two big ones. Yeah, we're only allowed an hour a day, so those are the two I watched, unless she wasn't home, then Gilligan's Island also, and then you just lie. I'm halfway to 90. I just had my birthday. Thanks. When I turned 40, my son said, you know, 40's not old for a tree. So, anyway, yeah, we're probably about the same age. So when we think about what we want to cut out, there are different influences that we might want to cut out from the environment that we're trying to create within our home. So there's the delineation and then the question, what are we cutting out? Cutting is a feminine trait. Cutting is part of Bina. Honing, this is a Kabbalistic thing, honing and shaping is part of the feminine characteristic. That's why it's on the left side. I'll get my lefts and rights right for right now. It's on the left side of the shape of the spherot, if you know what the spherot kind of look like, how they're shaped out. But Bina's on the left, because the left side, and this is all Kabbalistic stuff, I don't understand this, I'm just telling you what a few little pieces that I learned. The left side is the side of the severities, so Bina is a severe thing. So when I first learned that Bina is feminine and severe, I was wondering, what does that mean? How could it be a severe thing, and why is that related to femininity? But part of Bina, which means understanding, it comes from the word bain, to distinguish between like hamavdil bain kodesh lachol, bain or lachoshech, bain is Bina. Part of understanding things in between means delineating, separating out, and cutting off. And it's the cutting off in order to shape, which is severe. So if you want to make a garment, you can buy 5 yards of fabric, but then you have to cut away the pieces that you don't want in order to create the shape that you do want. So cutting away is a feminine task, or a task of the feminine energy, and in order to create the shape that you want. So it is an act of building. Bina is also from the root build, leave note, or the ben, which is also sun, but is building. So the building, though, requires distinguishing, delineating, and cutting in order to create the shape that you want. So all of that's wrapped up in the word bina. So that is important for us to all think about when we close our mem, when we close our home, what are we shutting out? And then when we open the door, what are we inviting in? So that's our home itself, the psychic space of our home, and then there's also the physical space of our home. We do have to think about the guests that we invite in, the friends that we invite in, the language that we allow in, the conversation that we allow in, and there's different times and places for all of that. Shabbos table is a different type of language than weekday table, and it's a different type of language with adults than it is with children, and different types of language with husbands and their friends than it is in mixed company. You know, I mean, husbands can sometimes say, step into my office, so they, it's not their office, but they just step aside so they can tell the jokes they want to tell as a bunch of men, because it's not appropriate to tell it with everybody around. So, in some houses, men tell jokes like that. Maybe not in all. Right, so that's part of delineating the space. So you want to create, you want to be proactive about creating a space that's the space that you want to create, because you're the creator of that space, and then filling that space. So part of creating the space is deciding what you will shut out, and then filling that space. So that is the task of creating the environment in which everyone dwells, in which the marriage dwells, in which the individuals in the home dwell, in which the children are raised, in which the guests feel comfortable. All of that is really at the hands of the woman who delineates and then fills space. So I brought you one pasuk here, which I didn't translate, just so you could hear it in Hebrew. I cut and pasted it in the Hebrew, and it all went backwards. So I said, instead of putting it in the mirror, and I didn't want to type in each letter, I just put it in the English. So, Chachmat Nashim Banta Beita V'Ivelet B'Yada Tarsena. That's from Mishlei. Chachmat Nashim, the wisdom of women, Banta Beita, builds her house. The Ivelet and the foolish woman, Biyadeha, with her hands, Tarsena. She tears it down. She tears down her home. So it's interesting to think about the difference here. The woman is building or destroying her home, destroying with her hands and building with her mind. Right? Because the chachmat nashim that builds, and it's the hands that destroy. So I'm not going to go into it. I don't really know what it means altogether, but something to think about when you have a chance. What's the difference between building with your mind and destroying with your hands? And where are you in that? And that it is on all of us. When things are destroyed, it's often we that are the destructive force. Not always, but often in our homes. So we have to think about how we can build and prevent destruction. Okay. Here are some tools on how to do that. So the first tool I put is tsniut. Tsniut, did I ever give my definition? Did I give that in here? My definition of tsniut? Okay. So I worked on this for a long time because I didn't have a problem. I had an initial problem, like the first year I was Jewish, with the whole tznius thing. But I pretty soon took to it and was happy with it and left it behind for an accomplished task that I was busy wearing skirts and long sleeves and high necks and whatever. And that was done. But what bothered me about it for years was that the word was such high praise. And what did that mean? I really couldn't figure out what is, when you say isha tznua, or isha tznua haita, she was a tzniastic woman. And that could be the highest praise. More than she had lots of guests, more than she taught Torah, more than she was wise, more than she whatever else. If you say isha tznua, that's like it. So I was wondering, it must be something more than the way I'm dressing if that's it. So what is it? So I worked on different definitions over the years. So I'll give you my interim definition, and then I'll give you my today definition. So my interim definition was the ability to focus on that which is important and not on that which is unimportant. So the ability to focus on that which is important to the exclusion of that which isn't important. So that covers dress, because I knew tznius is dress, and its behavior, and its speech, and its expenditures, all of that. So how does that work? So if you are focusing on that which is important, so in dress, face and hands, expressing of who you are, that's what's important. I heard, I think Esther Wien said, it's sort of like putting a diamond on a black velvet background. That's how we dress. We put our face on a, it doesn't have to be black, but on a background that's not distracting from what's really important. That's why you look at a diamond on black velvet, because you want to be able to see what's important without distractions around it. I went to the Hermitage. We went to Russia just after we got married, and I went to the Hermitage Museum in Russia, and it's not a well-run museum, but it has all the treasures of the Tsar. So all the Tsarina's snuff boxes were a collection, and they were all displayed in a case this size, probably 100 of them. All bejeweled, encrusted, gorgeous snuff boxes that were gifts from other heads of state around the world. Diamonds and pearls and emeralds and rubies, but they were one right next to each other. How could you possibly appreciate any one of them when they were all in one case, 100 of them, just in rows? It didn't say like we would have in our museum, right? It would be one in the middle of a black velvet or blue velvet background. It would say who gave it to her, when, where are the jewels, who was the artist, where, and then you can appreciate it, right? Wow, look at that. There's 12 diamonds and 47 pearls, and the pearls were harvested at this time from this harvester and from this special place, and that's why they're that color, and that's why they go with that. Like, it would be great to know all that stuff, but when you see 100 of them all together, there's no appreciating it. So what we try to do is focus on that which is important without all those distractions. So for our dress, it's face and hands. We don't want our physical bodies to distract from who we are. So we dress in that way. And we also want to spend in that way without distraction. And we also want to speak in that way without distraction. Focus on what's important. And don't get distracted by other foolish things. You shouldn't have conversations that take away from your focus in life. So that worked for me for several years. And then I came to a different understanding that's a little bit more sophisticated than that. So my current definition is, of tzinius, is a practice through which one quiets the voice of the physical so they can hear the voice of the spiritual. A practice through which one quiets the voice of the physical so you can hear the voice of the spiritual. I got to that because I had learned that tzinius occupies the same place of importance for a woman that Talmud Torah occupies for the man. So I was thinking, how could that be? How could it be that just, so could it be, it sort of works with the focus thing. I was thinking, how could it be exactly the same? Is it the same because it's a constant mitzvah? Is it the same because we live it all the time? Is it the same because we never have time off from it? How is it the same? But when I came up with this definition, I could totally see the sameness. If it's a practice through which one quiets the voice of the physical so they can hear the voice of the spiritual, it's the exact opposite of learning Torah, which is a practice through which one raises the voice of the spiritual so they drown out the voice of the physical. It's just opposite pathways for men and women. So men, if you go into a Beis Medrash, it's noisy. Right, and they're learning Torah very loud, and they're supposed to learn Torah all the time. They can take off for making a living, taking care of their family, resting, having some friendships. They are, but it's a constant mitzvah. So their mitzvah is to raise the voice of the spiritual, to drown out the voice of the physical. Ours is to quiet the voice of the physical, to allow the voice of the spiritual to be heard. But both of them are about balancing the voices. And we are physical and spiritual beings. So our quest is to be able to lead a spiritual life with the assistance of everything around us that's physical.
Isn't there some... I'm sorry.
Go on.
Can you repeat what it is? Go ahead and repeat it, but I have a question too.
Okay, our quest is to lead a spiritual life using everything that's physical in our lives to assist us with that. Rather than be distracted by the physical, to use the physical to help us along our journey. So what's your question?
Well, I don't know, it just seems like, I mean, I hear that, I understand what you're saying. But there is so much physical still in the quest and even in the world of tzinius. I mean, I have a favorite story. I'm at 770 at Crown Heights, and I'm, you know, looking for those great Shabbos suits. Because we don't get them in Denver,
right.
Colorado. I'm in New York, and I'm in Crown Heights, and I say to this young girl, that is a great suit. Where'd you get it? And I'm hoping she says around the corner, you know,
right.
Somewhere right there in Brooklyn. She looks at me, she goes, Neiman's. And I was like, we have Neiman's, Ryan.
Right.
So I was like,
right.
We have some great store with great shops.
Right.
So I hear it, and...
People, first of all, get distracted a lot. So even people who keep the halachas of tznius, they're dressing correctly, can be extremely distracted and not be tznius at all. So they can be dressing. You can dress the part because you live in a community, so you're wearing the uniform. It has nothing to do with tznius. So that for sure happens. Yes, yeah. So that happens. So there's uniform. And there's the in-crowd. You can just dress that way because that's the way the in-crowd dresses in your in-crowd. So there's that too. So tznius is that's why I say it's a practice through which. It's a lifelong practice. It's not a set of halachas. And it's not a way to behave. It's a practice through which.
It's a way to be. Right?
It's a way to be. So it's in everything. It's in the way you tell jokes. It's in the way you spend money. It's in the way you drive your car. It's in the type of car that you drive. It's in the way you decorate your home. It's in the way you set your Shabbos table. It's in the way that you have friendships and what you do for recreation. Where you go on your vacations and what you do on your vacations. Everything can be done in a tznius way. Tznius is each person working on a practice of understanding that they want to quiet the voice of the physical so they can hear the voice of the spiritual. So we get out of balance with that sometimes. Sometimes a lot. But like an airplane flight, an airplane flight starts when you file your chart with the airport, where you're going to go. So you take off here, you're going to land here, and you draw your line and say you're going to fly there. But when you're flying, you're usually here or here, constantly writing your way back onto the line. Right, so you're not necessarily on the line all the time. You're constantly off the line, trying to get back onto it. So that is the way that we, hopefully, if we have a conscious destination, and that's important, to have a destination and have a flight plan, then we always have to true ourselves to that plan. You know, we often are on one side or the other, erring on stringency, erring on leniency, erring on too much physical, erring on too much spiritual. We can get to too much spiritual, too. You know, there's a story of a wealthy man who really worked on himself to reduce the physical in his life, and he had sold his fancy furniture and his beautiful oriental carpets, and he moved from his large house into a smaller house, and he reduced the level of his servants, and he reduced the level of his meals, and he was finally to a place where he was eating basically bread and water. And he was really considering going to stale bread and water. And so he went to his Rav, and he said, "You know, this is what I've accomplished so far. What should be my next step?" And the Rav said, "You should eat 3 sumptuous meals a day. That's really important." He said, "What are you talking about? I just spent months, years trying to wean myself off of that." He said, "Well, you're a wealthy person, and you have a responsibility to live with that wealth and to share it with others. And if a poor person comes to you and they're hungry and you're eating bread and water, you're going to think that's good enough for them too. And it's not. Your job as a wealthy person is to eat 3 sumptuous meals a day." So then the question is, how sumptuous? Should you be flying in berries from the Alps? You know, I mean, it's a question. You know, how far do you go? So you always have to true your path.
So it makes sense to me that men are more physical, so they're the ones that have to raise the spiritual in order to drown out the physical, and the women are able to push down the physical in order to hear the spiritual. And it makes sense that we do that as individuals, but as a couple, mm-hmm. how do we work together as a couple to achieve the goal of being, to achieve our goals together when we're achieving it in different ways? How do we do it as a couple?
So I think you can look at it like a business. I mean, look at a business model. In a business model, in a shul model, right? So you need somebody to be the chief rabbi and somebody to be the second rabbi and somebody to be the program director and somebody to be the financial person. But you all have a goal of a well-functioning shul. You all have a goal of a healthy congregation. So the goal, you have to share your goal and you have to sit down and discuss what is the goal that we all want to achieve, but we each have different skills that we bring to accomplishing that goal. So your goal is a healthy, happy home, a healthy, happy marriage. Your home should be a place of refuge for you both, a place of peace and relaxation and growth for you both and for your children too. So that's both of your goals. The question is, how will you both bring your strengths to achieving that goal?
So, but you're achieving them in parallel then and not together.
Sometimes it's parallel work and sometimes it's together work. So for instance, setting your goal is together work. Right, so, and that does sometimes require actually sitting down. That's part of the homework that I have here. And then I did put, see yourself as the creator of the world, emulate Hashem and create the world you want. But here's a tip for that. Draw a picture of the world you want, whether with images or with words, so that you can constantly ask yourself, pause and reflect, is what I'm doing now accomplishing the world that I want to create? But you have to have a destination. That's communal work. And then, once you have a destination that's clear, you're in concert with each other, because you've agreed to be that way, about how, about pausing and reflecting, about truing each other. You've given each other permission to help each other true the course. So you've asked, please, if you see me going away from our mission of the home that we want to create, please let me know. And he can help you, and you can help him. And then you'll work on, maybe your feelings got hurt the last time he let you know. So then you can work on better methods together of how he can tell you things without it hurting your feelings, how you can tell him things without him feeling judged. But, so it is a communal thing, but there's parallel work and communal work at the same time. Any other questions before I continue with this?
Yeah.
Pardon?
It's very beautiful.
So, okay, so that is a tool, I think. Tznius is a tool in understanding that your goal, the goal of the couple is to bring the voices into a parallel so that you can be in choice about which voice you'd like to follow. Right? So, and then each one of you works on it a different way. So Tznius is your tool to work on quieting the voice of the physical so that the voice of the spiritual can be heard. And that is in how you create your environment in your home. You know, what is the environment that you're creating? Isn't it an environment that's focusing on the physical so that you're constantly thinking about how you're going to decorate the next thing? Or is it decorated in a way that creates relaxation, creates a sense of peace when you walk in? You know that your home is a refuge. When you walk in the door, there's a exhale ability where you just know this is home. So that your decorating choices are based on that. So it doesn't mean you can't decorate. It just means you need to think about, how am I spending my time, my money, my energy in creating this environment? Okay, so that's the tool of Tznius. Bina. So the tool of Bina is a tool of building. So here I just want to say one thing, one place where we can use, we have extra strength in Bina. And our extra strength in Bina can hurt our husbands sometimes. Sometimes we might ask our husbands, what's wrong? Tell me what happened. And they don't want to. Why? Not because they don't want to share with you. Because you understand too much. They could tell the same story to their therapist or their friend or their boss or their colleague. And they can put a little spin on it that will help them save face a little bit. But not to you. You get it. You understand their personality. You know the situation. And when they tell you, they lay themselves bare in front of you. And they feel bad because you get it. And they don't necessarily want to be gotten that way. It's embarrassing. You don't always want your faults seen so clearly. And Bina allows us to see those faults very clearly. So it's important for us to use, just to think what our Bina is for, to build and not break. I like to have little mantras. They help me. So I was thinking about this, and I'm not sure it's perfect as a mantra yet, because at first I had build, don't intrude, but I like, you know, something that works well. Build, don't break has that better sound. So you can think about how you want to make your own mantra, but my goal here in the mantra is short, rememberable, repeatable to yourself when you need it in a situation, positive, avoid the negative. So your goal and how you're going to achieve it. Build, don't break. Or build, don't intrude. Build, don't invade. You don't want to invade their space. They have a space that they need to keep private and that they don't want to necessarily be vulnerable in front of you. And the Bina really can lay them bare. And you need to give them space to have that privacy from you when they need it.
To mothers also?
I think it's a little different there. We definitely have to be careful as mothers, but mothers are much more there to guide, and it's not always by agreement. Whereas with spouses, there has to be the agreement. You know, you're in that relationship by choice and by choice only, whereas parent and child is not a choice relationship. You can never leave it. it could be bad.
But could you make a son vulnerable to an exposure that they don't want to through the same bina?
I think you can, but it's not going to be as embarrassing to them because they're not your lover. So they don't share with you on as deep a level. And they don't need your esteem as much. They do need your esteem. Children for sure need you to love them and cherish them and hold them in a high esteem. And they spend their lives trying to get their mothers to be proud of them. But it's not the same as a spouse. Your husband needs you to be proud of him. And if he flubbed in business or whatever it is, lost the money in the stock market, when you told him not to make that investment, you know, it's so hard. So it is important to give him space. Space for that to be in private.
So, right. But isn't the bina something that's, I mean, if I understand what you're saying, isn't it something that's really very special about us, that we are interested inside of them?
Yes.
So therefore, using that and us knowing them so closely is really a tool to build them up.
Yes.
I could see it more with our children because, you know, I have teenagers. Mm-hmm. And I could see more that they need to be kept private. But my husband, you know, he tells me things because
that's great. If he's telling you and you're building him, that's great. And the bina is for understanding and building. But what I'm saying is sometimes a husband is shutting down and sometimes you have to let him be more private about something and not pry into it. Not try to be able to understand so you can tell him what you understand about how he should and shouldn't. Unless he asks for that. If he wants that from you, if he comes to you for counsel, for sure share. But you want to keep in mind that the goal of your bina yus is building and not breaking. Right. It's very easy for us to go into break. It's very easy to cross that line. It's very easy to say, well, I know how to build you. If you would do this, that, and the other thing, the way I say you should do this, that, and the other thing, then, you know, and meanwhile, you just broke them to pieces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? So you really have to keep in mind that the goal of the bina yus is to build. And that's why I think it's good to think of your own mantra, build, not break, and say it to yourself. So I find that with teenagers, my mantra, and I put this on here, I think. Maybe I didn't put it on yours. I didn't, but I put it down by educate. My mantra for educate is educate, don't berate. And I use that with my teens all the time, in my head. It's my own private mantra. Don't yell at them. Berate is yelling or tearing them down. You know, how ridiculous that you, bless you, you know, did whatever you did, right? So, but that's not the thing. They took something out of the oven for you, you made an apple cobbler, you peeled 20 apples, you made the whole thing, they took it out, but they didn't use hot pads. They thought they'd be able to take it out fast. Or they used their t-shirt and it didn't protect them enough and they dropped it. Right? Now it's on the floor. Educate, don't berate. Right? That's where I would use my mantra. Educate, don't berate. Because what I want to do is teach them, you know, first of all, the value of what, you know, I do want to teach them, rather than yelling at them, berating, do you know how long it took me to peel all those apples and now I don't have dessert for Shabbos and it's ridiculous and I can't believe that you used your t-shirt and that was so stupid. No, that's berating. Educate. If you use a thicker hot pad, it won't burn your hands. When you use your t-shirt, you have the risk of burning your hands and now you can see what happened. And it took me a long time to make that and I'm pretty frustrated about it, but I'm educating instead of berating.
Okay, so how do you transfer that to your husband as far as, like, because not that you need to educate them because that in a way is kind of demeaning.
Right.
But I mean, if they make mistakes that you think they shouldn't realize that they shouldn't do that.
Right. So you never ever want to berate. That never ever helps you.
So what do you say?
So you can try educating sometimes. I mean, a lot of techniques that work with...
At that time, it's like, you know, you don't pull so hard on that thing and it won't break the next time.
Right, so sometimes you can say it that way. Sometimes you just say... So sometimes you just have to say it that way. This shade is loose. It has to be pulled lightly or it falls.
I mean, doesn't that...
That's all.
I mean, why is it...
Yes, and yet it wasn't obvious to them. So that's why we have to educate them.
I had a mentor person back east. She was married 64 years. And I just remember her saying, nothing is obvious to men. Because I was very frustrated. It was just like, if he sees that the na-na-na needs to be done, he can just do it.
Right.
Yeah. And she said to me, and I'll remember this always, nothing is obvious to men.
Even if they've seen it three or four times.
She was like, nothing is obvious.
Because they learn a different way than we do.
Yeah, but that's rather arrogant to say that. Sometimes I just stuff that my husband looks at me and thinks I'm so stupid as well, believe me.
Yes.
I mean, I think that when I want to berate somebody, you know, husband especially, I think to myself, I'm not perfect for you.
So that's good. So everybody, right, so everybody has to, right, so everybody has to think of their own ways. So if you have a pathway that works for you, that's great. The point here is berating never has a place. Tearing people down never has a place. It never, ever helps. Never. Right?
No, no.
It never does.
It's not that you're tearing them down. It's just, you know, when you're talking about with your teenagers, you know, you're educating them, but it's like, if they're always going to be like that, like,
then
men
so,
don't get it. What's the point?
Right.
Of
so sometimes.
You need to do a communication.
Right, right. I often tell my sons that I'm training you for your wife, your future wife. You know, I want you to understand this and I want you to learn that because I want my daughter-in-law to be happy with the work that I did because we are in partnership. We're both working together to raise this man.
So I think the next class should be techniques. I mean, this is very kind of like up here. You know, it's very philosophical and that kind of stuff. But I think we need to get into
tactical.
So here, I'm giving you some tactics. The truth is, I'm giving you some tactics, but you can't give tactics. I mean, you can. People can do it. People can do it, but it won't be effective. Because each person is so different. So I'm giving you general tactics, but the truth is, you have to make it yours. I can offer you the toolbox, but if you don't take the tools home and use them, you'll never figure them out. It's like using Facebook, Lahav deal. If you don't turn it on and play with it, you'll never get it. Right? You can't get it from somebody explaining it to you. You won't know what it is. Anybody who's used it already understands that once you start to play with it, you understand it in a totally different way. If I'll tell you it's social networking, what does that mean? Nothing. But if you know how to Facebook, it means something. So the same thing with all of these tools. I can tell you have mantras, but if you don't use them, it means nothing. So you do actually have to practice it in your daily life and pick one or two at a time that you're working on so that you can integrate that. You can't do it all at once either. So you might want to start with educate, don't berate. You might want to start with teenagers. You might want to start with a pause before I say anything, which is not easy.
That is so hard.
Right. It's not easy. But you might want to try it for a day or an hour. Or you might say from at supper time, I'm just going to practice pausing. And then you'll see you don't. And then you just practice again. I'm just practicing pausing. That's it. For everything, you know, for 2 hours or whatever it is. But you do have to practice using these tools and see what works for you. Right, that's good. Right. I've put myself in timeout before.
Oh, yeah.
No, I close the door and I say, Eva is in timeout. Close. sometimes the Ema needs that. But fortunately, I mean, that was when they were little. Okay. Let's go to privacy for just a minute. So we talked about Bina and Bina, using our Bina carefully and using it, making sure that we don't invade privacy with our Bina skills. Okay, so privacy. Intimacy deepens when privacy is built. When you are trustworthy that you will respect the privacy of your husband and of your children and of your friends, the intimacy of each one of those relationships deepens quite a bit. They can share a lot more with you when they know you're not sharing it with somebody else. We do need to share sometimes, but we should start to be careful about how we share. In a group like this, or with our friends, it's important to say things, not to say, my husband did, but to say, I know there are couples where the husband does. Right? And then you might be sharing about somebody else's marriage also. You've been to other people's houses, you've seen other couples, but it is important not to say, my husband or my mother-in-law. I have a close relative who? I know of couples where the in-laws do, but you shouldn't make it so, I mean, sometimes, and closer friends will be able to tell, and then you do have to be more careful. What are you going to share and what not? But it is important to protect the privacy of those people who are close to you. So where it gets tricky is when you need to share, because it's you, it's your story, but your story is your kid's story, and your story is your marriage. Right? So it's, right, the kids,
yeah,
for sure.
And they come back at you, too.
Yes, they do.
Tell
right.
Everybody everything.
Right, exactly. So we do need to be more careful with that. So we might want to try weaning ourselves at first, because it is a bad habit. So you might want to try picking one friend that you share, or one counselor, or a friend and a counselor, where you pick, but pick a specific person that you're going to share that stuff with, and then nobody else. And then there is no place to ask somebody else, so, how's your kid doing in school? Sometimes you're just asking that question because you want to share that your kid is doing great or doing poorly or you're having a hard time. So you're opening conversation. But really, it's not appropriate to ask somebody else. You might say, how are things going? Are you feeling okay? Or especially if they shared something with you, then you might want to follow up. But just to start a conversation with, you know, how are things going in a certain area, that you're inviting them to share things that really invade the privacy of other people in their lives. And we need to work on protecting that privacy. So helping our friends protect the privacy of their family members. And asking our friends, please help me when I slip up. That's why it's great in a group like this, because we're friends. So we can say, as friends, say, I want to be more careful in protecting the privacy of my family, and so that means our conversations are going to be a little different. And I would ask you to please remind me if I slip up, and please understand if I don't share the way I have shared, because I do. My first fidelity has to be to my family. So that's an important thing. So you might want to think about pictures you put on Facebook. Okay. Here's a phrase for you to, oh gosh. Chachma begoyim tamin, Torah begoyim al tamin. We do understand that there's chachma in the nations. The nations have a chachma. So I'm going to share a chachma from somebody in the nations, which is Stephen Covey. So his habit number 6 in the 7 habits of highly effective people is seek to understand and then be understood. From that habit, he has one phrase where he says, be true to others. This is not the exact quotes, paraphrase. Be true to others even when they're not around. This is not about Shemir Salushan. It is also, but I'm not going there. This is not the halachas of it. This is when you talk to a friend and you talk to your friend about a friend or about your husband or about your child, they wonder then what you say about them when you're talking to somebody else. Your friend's confidence in you and your honesty and your privacy is built by you not sharing private things with them that shouldn't be shared. Right? So being true to others when the others aren't around will help build your relationships and your communication and the honesty that's possible when necessary if you do need a confidant to share something. And then you know they can trust you and you can trust them. So that's habit number 6. Okay, skip step 2. This is a tool that's so helpful. And some of you have heard it before, but skips. Right, I told you at Federation, this is my message for that talk, so this is just one of the tools for this talk, so I won't go into it so deeply, but this is a fabulous tool, and it's very helpful in creating a healthy family environment, healthy marriage environment. Step 1, something frustrating happens. Step 2, blame, shame, yell. Step 3, take care of the problem. You have to take care of the problem whether or not you blame, shame, yelled. Right? Whether or not you're upset. Why bother getting upset? The apple crisp is on the floor. Your 20 apples are gone. It's before you swept. There's dog hairs there. You can't extricate it. Right? It's done. My house has dogs. We have dog hair all the time. So, right? So it's gone. But it's gone whether or not you're upset with your teen. It's gone whether or not you yell at them. So it might as well be gone and not add to that the frustration between parent and child, or not add to that your frustration. Why should you be frustrated about it? Why should you lose your apple crisp dessert and be frustrated? It's enough you lost your apple crisp. So just skip the frustration. Now, I know it sounds hard, but it does work over time. So today I was going down Colfax over the viaduct, and right at the light, a car was making a turn. I stopped behind him because he was stopped waiting for the turn. And another car, he made the turn, and another car didn't realize that I was stopped and smacked right into the back of my car.
Oh, no.
So I don't even exactly know what happened. I was with my daughter. Neither of us were hurt, but we were hit hard enough that my hat fell off, and I didn't realize it. So I feel like there might have been like an instant of not knowing what happened, because I went to get out of the car, and Vita said, "Ema, your hat." So I put it on. It was this one, so all the ribbons got like weirded out, and so I'm like trying to tuck them in and like get out in the wind, and like, and then my heart is racing. And somebody across that was walking down the way was laughing so hard and mean, you know, really being nasty. So the guy gets out of his car and he's like, "I'm so sorry, what happened?" I said, "And I was late for an appointment." I wasn't late for an appointment. I was on time for an appointment, and I didn't want to be late. I've been working on being on time. So I didn't want to have to be late. So I did not want to have to wait for police to come, and I didn't want there to be damage because it would just get in my way of being on time. So I decided to get out. I got out, and I realized I have to be responsible here. If there's damage, I have to get his information. Fortunately, there wasn't damage. Fortunately, we both felt fine. His bumper was dented a little bit. He was feeling frustrated. He told me he's out of work for 6 months, and his food stamps got lost, and he just went to the unemployment office, and they lost his check, and he left his glasses there, and he's going back to pick them up. And it's so hard. And he like spit onto his hanky and wiped off the bumper, and he said, "I think it just got scratched." And I said, "Well, let's just exchange information because that's the responsible thing to do." But you know, so we did that, and I was able to go. But before he left, he was flustered, and I said, "You should have blessing in your life, and you know, things should go well for you." And so when I got back in the car, Viva said, "Wow, he was lucky he hit you instead of somebody else." But it's because I have practiced skip step two. You know, anyway, I had to stop and check. Anyway, I might be late. Why should I be upset about it too? And why should I be angry with him about it? He was irresponsible. He dropped a pen. He was picking it up. He wasn't paying attention. He said that. But I don't need to yell at him about it. You know, he knows he was irresponsible. He felt bad about it. That's enough.
But what about if he was, it sounds like he was being a nice guy about it. But what about if he was being a jerk, like the guy that was laughing his head off at you?
Right, so then...
Would you still skip step two?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, because I need, to be laughed at, berated, and be angry with him?
You wouldn't have angry feelings?
I'm working on that.
So you won't go to the level, that
low level. And that is my destination. Mm-hmm. I am working on not being frustrated over those things. One of I learned from the Tverskys. The Tverskys don't... They have a masorah of not worrying.
Really? What is that?
That's just their masorah. The Tversky family doesn't worry. Either you can take care of the situation, or you can't. So you either do something about it, or you let it go. But worry's in between. There's no reason to worry. And so the Tverskys on Friday nights eat farfel to remind themselves that the week is farfallen, which means has gone away, and the cares and concerns have gone away, and now it's just time to start with a clean slate. So there are different practices that we can incorporate into our life, which will help us create the world that we want to create. Yeah? Did you? Oh, no, I don't know about this Tversky, but the Tversky family. All right, we're almost out of time, but I'm not going to let you go before. Let's see. I just put one pasuk from Megillat Esther here, because it's such a nice pasuk. This is for really more for parenting, but for all family relationships. The last pasuk in Megillat Esther praises Mordechai, for Mordechai the Jew was viceroy to King Ahasuerus, great among the Jews, accepted by most, not all, of his brethren, even him, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his seed. So the commentaries say all his seed, that's his children and his grandchildren. Most people have a child or a grandchild who doesn't listen, who doesn't do what they want. But Mordechai spoke peacefully to all of them. That's his top praise, because that's the end of the Megillah. So before I let you go, I just want to talk about relationship to the physical. All of this relates to the sexual relationship in marriage, because it's all about that relationship is about focus and about removing distractions from that focus. So the sneakiest way to have a marital relationship is to use the physical to create the spiritual relationship, is to focus on your spouse, focus on yourself, focus on the relationship, focus on the pleasure, and to exclude other thoughts. We can practice this when we're davening. We focus on Hashem, and we need to exclude other thoughts. We shouldn't be making shopping lists. when we're davening or when we're with our husbands. We shouldn't be thinking about other people during either time. And conversation that happens between a couple during intimate times should never mention somebody else, even if something happened in the day. So there's pillow talk at different times, but not when you're intimate and not when you're close, not when you're moving up and not when you're moving down. That's not the time, not in the cycle of the whole lovemaking experience. You should not be talking about other people at all. Way before, then you can talk about other people according to the laws of halacha and all that stuff. But inside that intimate space, no other people are allowed to come. Not in conversation, not in thought, not in image. It is a training to focus only on that person and on the relationship. So self, them, and the relationship that you're creating. So we want to practice focusing, allowing and inviting focus on ourselves, focusing on our relationship, and then excluding other concerns, excluding other images, and excluding other thoughts from that relationship. So we want to shut the door there and not let anybody else in to that space. That's a space that needs to be closed. Once we've figured out the space that we want to create, then we can open the door, not to our bedrooms, of course, but to our homes, and let people in once we understand what space we want to create and what fits inside that space and what doesn't. But first we do need to start with a closed space or delineating that space so that we understand what it is we're trying to create, how we're trying to build. So the homework, which I won't be able to ask you about, but still is your homework, is to see yourself as creator of the world. Because you are. You are a creator of your world. And we need to emulate Hashem in choosing the world that we want to create. Hashem gave us that gift. It's up to us. We get to create what we want. So I would say create your goal with your husband and then work on achieving that goal. Taking time, train yourself to pause and ask, is this action, sentence, activity, expenditure, interaction, choice helping me create the world that I want? And I'll end with a bracha that everybody should have the strength, the clarity, the energy, the desire, and the partnership to create the worlds that you want. All right. Okay, so if anybody would like to, next week and the week after, have a Pesach class in this time period, I'd be happy to offer that. The Pesach class that I'm thinking about would not be philosophy, but it would be practical. How do you actually make it happen? How do you plan the cleaning? How do you plan the household? How do you get it together? How do you stay sane? So my goal, because I'm into goals and means, my goal for that class would be how to make Pesach on time, keeping your sanity and your desire intact. So, both. So I just gave a bracha. I didn't make it into a bracha. So I just gave a bracha that you should be able to create the world that you want to create and have enough clarity and koach and partnership to create that.
How do you decide if you're going to do the class?
So I guess Donnie is in charge of organizing it.
So does everyone know, just from a show of hands, who would potentially be interested in a class like that?
Would it be Wednesday or would it be
next Tuesday is Purim. Next Tuesday night is Purim. So it'll be the two Tuesdays after that?
Or we could move it to a Monday.
Right. This Monday I have a board meeting. The following I don't.
Okay, so we can do it.
You kind of want this. Well, we can this Monday. Yeah, we don't, because it's Purim. So we probably have one next. Kathy, what do we have one next?
We have one on Thursday.
We have one on Thursday, but then we have one not this Monday, because Purim, Monday, but the following one.
So would that be 3 weeks before Purim?
Right, so then it already is getting into time problems. Should we do it Sundays? Sunday night is the other class.
So if we wait 3 weeks, then that'll be 2 weeks before.
Right.
That's 2 weeks.
So let's look at the schedule. Let's look at the schedule.
Okay.
We do Thursdays.
Right. Yeah, I can do Thursdays, except for this week. Yeah. Yeah, I can do Thursdays.
So would everyone be interested in a Thursday? A Thursday night?
Because this coming up week, so then that's Purim, Shushan Purim, Thursday night. That's when we have that. No, that's this week, because Thursday is that board meeting.
So would that be too close, though? I mean, that's 3 weeks before Pesach.
So let's make it an hour and a half class and do it all at once, or 2 hour class and do it all at once. Should we do that? So we'll do a Pesach workshop that Thursday after Purim.
Thursday after Purim, maybe like 7 to 9.
Yeah, so 7 to 9, is that good?
Yeah.
What's the date then?
That's next. Next week. A 2-hour practical Pesach workshop. I'll bring you worksheets.
Thursday after Purim?
The Thursday after Purim, right.
It's the 12th.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll do it. So, and then if you want, we could do philosophy too. But do you have anybody doing philosophy of Pesach?
We do have a little bit here and there.
Uh-huh. Okay. So we'll do, for practical, we'll do the 2-hour class that Thursday.
So yeah. We start earlier?
7 to 9.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.